Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I'm your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find all of my work by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Well, for today's episode, we have a very special guest, and that is the one and only Bill Still. For anyone that doesn't know, Bill was a former journalist and newspaper publisher. His work has been featured in numerous different publications, including USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, Los Angeles Times Syndicate. He's the author of over 20 books, including his most recent, which is No More National Debt. And Bill Still might be familiar to more of you from his excellent movies. And these include the classic, The Money Masters, The Secret of Oz, and his most recent film, which is Jekyll Island, The Truth Behind the Federal Reserve. And Bill has spent much of his life fighting for monetary reform. Well, Bill Still, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Excellent. Well, I've invited Bill on to discuss monetary reform, and in particular, the gold standard. And anyone that gets into monetary reform activism, anyone that gets interested in this, gets fascinated by the Fed and how it actually works and functions, inevitably, unfortunately, you get kind of sucked into this gold bug frenzy, and you see that, you know, gold is the only answer to all of our monetary problems and all of life's problems. And Bill has spent much of his life trying to counter this. And as we'll go into in the podcast, there are lots of reasons that we should sort of stay away from this. But Bill, perhaps before we start, maybe we could just, for the listeners who may not be up to speed on this, just define a couple ideas and terms that we're going to be talking about. So first and foremost, how is our money created today? Because this is something that, you know, if you ask the man on the street, they'll say, oh, well, the Fed creates our money or the Treasury. But there's a little bit more to that. So maybe you could explain that to the listeners briefly.
Yeah, the average person thinks that the government creates the money. And that's not the case. But the reason they believe that is because they intuitively know that that's the way it should be. The very definition of sovereignty, the most important power of a sovereign nation, is to create the money for all citizens equally, and create it without debt. However, unfortunately, we've been hoodwinked by the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 into thinking that this is the case, that the government creates the money because the Fed – most people believe that the Fed is part of the government when, in fact, the Fed is a private corporation. And we have Fed officials on tape admitting that they're a private corporation. I mean, it's not like it's a dark conspiracy. It's a fact. The Fed is a private corporation, and who are its stockholders? Its only stockholders are the banks of the United States. So therefore, a corporation must serve the interest of its stockholders. That is a fact. And since we, the people of the United States, are not stockholders, the Fed can never serve the public interest. It must serve the interest of the commercial banks. And that's exactly what's going on. 97% of our money is created by commercial banks, not by the government, not by the Fed. Created by commercial banks as an interest-bearing debt. The only money that is created by the government are the coins in your pocket. So this is the first basic lie that completely throws people into a state of confusion, that the Fed is part of the government and that either the government or the Fed creates the money. It's just not so.
Absolutely. And what is fractional reserve banking? Because this is another one of these terms that I think to the average person they might be a little bit confused about. But as you go into in all of your films, it's really not that difficult to understand. So please just explain that to the listeners.
No, it's not difficult to understand. It's the Fed's theoretical way of preventing banks from creating too much money through lending. They require a certain amount of reserves. Theoretically, those reserves are supposed to be 10 to 1. In other words, if they have $1,000 on hand, the banks can lend out $10,000. Well, that's not That's shocking. It should shock everybody. But it's even worse than that. We found out in 2008, as a result of congressional hearings following the crash of 2007, that the major banks, J.P. Morgan, Citi, those types, Bank of America, were leveraged on average 52 to 1, not 10 to 1. 52 to 1. That means they had less than $2 on hand for every $100 they were lending out. Well, keep in mind, this is money. In other words, they're creating 98% of they're creating 52 times the amount of money they actually have. They create that money out of nothing. They get the seniorage, the profit out of creating money. Then they have the gall to lend it to us and get interest on that. Then, if we don't manage to pay back the indebted amount, they get to foreclose and confiscate our possessions. Then, with that extra money, what do? They go and they buy off, one, the major media, two, the politicians, and three, now within the last 30 or 40 years, the academic class, in other words, the professors of economics. So it is a fact today that if you wish to be a successful economist in the United States or even in Europe, you cannot possibly publish something in a major economics journal against this debt money system. You just can't do it. And as soon as you try to do it, you will be ostracized. You'll never get tenure at a major university or any university. You might as well throw your career away. And so therefore, I mean, who does the media rely on when they want to find out, well, what's the truth behind this? You know, is really our money created out of debt, or is it, you know, they call a professor. Well, what's a professor going to say? Is he going to go on CBS Evening News or NBC and say, yeah, it's the Fed is just a big scam. They're allowing the banks to create money out of nothing, and they do virtually whatever they want. They're supposed to be held to 10 to 1 on this fractional reserve lending deal, but in essence, they do whatever they want. We found out in 2008 the big banks were leveraged 52 to 1. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were leveraged 80 to 1. The big trading houses like Goldman Sachs were leveraged 333 to 1. That's what fractional reserve lending is.
It is actually, when you start exploring this, it is the biggest scandal that you could imagine in human history, the way that the banks have, and so, you know, infiltrated all aspects of our life. And I mean, if you control the money, you control everything. You can, as you said, you control the political process, the media, academia, and it's very easy to mold public opinion to favor these big banks.
And still, the forces of monetary reform are ever growing worldwide now over the internet. And I predict that eventually we will somehow, I don't know how, but we will somehow be able to crack through, get one nation to adopt some variant of monetary reform. That nation will be attacked, but it will still weather the storm. It'll still thrive and be happy, and then other nations will eventually fall. Because the internet generation, the people who were born right around the turn of the century, are not going to put up with this. They, you know, there's a core group of them, probably your age, who understand what's going on, and as time develops, they are going to be the leaders of the world, and they're not going to put up with this once they figure it out.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, we're going to be discussing the gold standard, because this is, when you get into this, that's generally the kind of reform that you hear. And full disclosure, I used to be an ardent gold bug. I would get into these sort of knockdown, screaming fights with all of my friends about how we had to have, you know, sound money. We had to have gold. This was the only alternative to what we have. And it wasn't until I watched your films, The Money Masters, The Secret of Oz, and Jekyll Island, that I started to see that there was something else going on. And when you get into the whole gold bug movement, you hear a version of history that is very persuasive. You know, I mean, there's a reason that a lot of people fall into this gold myth, But perhaps we could explore a little bit the actual history of gold as money. And in your films, you know, you go all the way back to the time of Jesus. You talk about Caesar, and perhaps we can talk a little bit about that and how the goldsmiths sort of invented much of the fractional reserve system and used their power in controlling the gold to create money.
Well, that's a very long question. I don't know
well,
where to start.
We can just kind of briefly, you know, I guess just let's just pick up on the whole idea of goldsmiths, how they operated many years ago, and maybe we can just get a little bit to why they like gold so much.
Well, first of all, you said something that was very interesting, and that's you kind of based your belief in a gold money system. One of the core tenets was that it provided sound money. Mm. Sound money is a good thing. What is sound money? I'm asking you.
Oh. Well, I mean, as far as I know from the, you know, sound money is gold, is something that is...
No. What are the attributes of sound money?
Oh, well, I guess it would be something that is stable, I'm assuming.
Stable. What is stable?
Money that wouldn't fluctuate up and down, money that would sort of stay at a constant value. And
okay.
I guess
now we're getting down to the core. What sound money means is money where the quantity is controlled, where it doesn't get out of hand, where you don't have wild fluctuations in money. Sound money is a good thing. Okay, let's go to the graphs. Let's look at the period of the 1920s. This was called the oh my, I'm having a brain lock here. The period of the 1920s.
Oh, the Roaring Twenties.
The Roaring Twenties. Oh my goodness, that's what happens when you get to be my age. You have brain locks. But in any case, so what did the Roaring Twenties imply? It implied that a wild stock market situation, where if you look at the graph, there's never been such a wild increase in the value of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and that was because of wild money printing, and that was because it wasn't really printing, it was that the banks were really starting to rev up this fractional reserve lending thing. They were throwing money into the economy. They couldn't believe that they could actually do it now that the Federal Reserve System was passed, and they started doing it. So it caused this humongous bubble. And then, of course, when that bubble broke, that led to the Great Depression of the 1930s. So keep in mind, we were on a total gold-only money system during this period. Gold did not create sound money. Gold did not control the quantity. That's what leads to my saying that I made up, and that is, it's not what backs money that's important. All that matters is who controls the quantity. Who was controlling the quantity of money in the 1920s and the 1930s? The banks and the Fed. And that's why the Fed, Mr. Bernanke himself, has admitted that after Milton Friedman did an entire paper showing that the Fed created the Great Depression in the 1930s by deliberately contracting the quantity of money and leaving it contracted for that whole time. And so Bernanke, at the occasion of Milton Friedman's 90th birthday, made this very famous speech where he says, "Yes, Milton, you're right. We did do it, but we've learned and we'll never do it again." This was in 1995 or something like that, whatever. It was in the 1990s. Well, of course, they just held to that for maybe 2 or 3 years.
Oh, yeah, right.
Before they started doing it again. Mm. So it doesn't matter what backs the money. I mean, gold, silver, fiat, that's not the question. This is a diversionary question so that we won't look at the real thing. The real thing is, who is the guy in control of it? Mm. Right now, the U.S. government does not control it. Why? Because the government is borrowing from these thieves. The borrower shall be servant to the lender. If a sovereign nation borrows one penny, one lira, one franc, one Deutschmark from a commercial bank, it is no longer the sovereign. The root of this problem is government borrowing. We cannot do a single thing to fix our monetary system until not pay down the debt. We can't pay down the debt. It's impossible. We have to eliminate it and call the existing debt onerous debt, which is a perfectly legit international concept. Now, we can't just negate or erase all of the debt. There's a way that we can gradually get out of this, but you know, your pension funds all have loads of government debt, et cetera, et cetera. But over 50% of it is owned by banks and related financial institutions. So they're the ones that hold by far the majority of this debt, and so they are the ones who are the sovereign. And until we attack that problem and understand that is the root of all of our other problems. As William Jennings Bryan said in his 1896 presidential run, without monetary reform, no other reform is possible, because all the things that you're trying to reform relate to the fact that the bankers are controlling everything.
Of course. I mean, that is really at the heart of every issue, poverty, many times war, all sorts of different aspects that you wouldn't really immediately associate with the banks are essentially, I mean, that's who's running the show for in you know, so much.
Fractional reserve lending, this whole debt money system, as I put it, is the primary cause of most of the world's hunger, poverty, misery, and disease. So, you know, fixing this in one generation even is a mighty task, but a mighty worthy task.
And now maybe we can kind of shift into a little bit why the gold bugs have this reverence to a metal. And of course, like I said, you know, I used to really believe much of this, and they'll take things like the American Revolution, and they'll talk about continental scrip, which was fiat money produced by the continental government, and they'll
let me stop you right there, because if you start asking too many questions, my weak little brain isn't going to handle it.
Oh, okay.
And the continental script answer is perfectly simple. Congress was in control of the quantity of money during the Revolution. Continental script worked just fine until Britain parked two counterfeiting ships in Boston Harbor and started counterfeiting continental script by the bale. This was not the doing of the U.S. Congress. According to a recent Harvard study, this was the doing of the British using essentially economic terrorism as one of their weapons of war. And it worked great, and they almost beat us because of that. The famous George Washington quote, wagon load of money will barely buy a wagon load of groceries. But that wasn't – it was because who was controlling the quantity? It was not the U.S. government. It was the British, and they were trying to destroy the value of money by counterfeiting it.
And, of course, the real true cause of the American Revolution had to do with Britain insisting that the colonies pay their taxes in gold, which they really didn't have very much of there.
Right. The Americans didn't have very many gold mines, and so they were – bereft of gold and silver. That's why America had to become a place of monetary experimentation from the very get-go. That's at the core of the United States. And the British hated it because America was getting out of control. It was becoming prosperous without measure. The British didn't understand why it was happening. And it was happening, according to Benjamin Franklin, because we'd found the secret that we can create our own money. We don't have to pay interest on it. We just make it up. And if we make up too much and it causes inflation, well, that's our problem. You know, so if you want to have a government that wants to become extinct overnight, then just go ahead and print too much of the doggone stuff. But it's not. But you know, it certainly is within the power of a sovereign national government to do that. If they want to thrive, then they control it tightly and correctly. If they want to destroy themselves, well, then go ahead and destroy themselves. But that is their right, their prerogative, and they should have the right to do that. And people should have the right if a government does become suicidal, monetarily suicidal, to install a new government that will perform its sovereign functions correctly.
Mm. And indeed, much of American history has been a fight between the big banks and the average person or politicians. Of course, we can look at Andrew Jackson. We can look at William McKinley and the William Jennings Bryan election. I mean, that whole election was about gold versus silver.
The William McKinley posters, political posters that still exist, show five or six guys holding up a big gold coin with William McKinley standing on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this was not a secret.
I know. Yeah. And it's amazing. People back then were the average rural farmer who had no real formal education, say, had a very firm grasp on monetary policy at that time. And now it's people, obviously, like you said, it is growing. But back then, I mean, people understood the reality of this.
Yeah, they understood it, but it was still a question of it was not thoroughly understood that scarce money didn't work. Scarce money being gold money, as opposed to plentiful money. You know, the argument was still the same. Well, if the government has control of it, they'll just print too much of it, and you know, we'll all go to hell in a handbasket. But it was still a lively debate and an open question. But at least the question was right out in the open. Mm. Now the whole thing is so obscured with so many different variations that the average person, unless they want to just spend a lot of time looking into it, has a very tough time making heads or tails out of the whole thing.
Mm. Well, maybe now perhaps we can explore a little bit more about why gold itself is so dangerous, and maybe we can pick this up with your own personal story as it relates to your investigation into Fort Knox. This is where, supposedly, we are told, you know, all of our gold is, and I guess in theory, if the gold bugs had their way, we would use the gold in Fort Knox to create a 100% gold dollar. But please tell the listeners a little bit about what you discovered when you started investigating the gold in Fort Knox.
Well, I got onto the trail of this. I was a newspaper reporter. I was actually the publisher. But, you know, I came up as a newspaper reporter, and an old guy called me up on the phone one day and said, "Boy, have I got a story for you. There's no gold left in Fort Knox." And I just kind of rolled my eyes because when you run a newspaper, you get a crazy guy, you know, every week, and they'll just literally suck every minute of your time up with their story. And so I developed this way of getting them off the phone, just to, you know, work more efficiently. I said, "Oh, that's great. Send me something in the mail." Click, and hung up. You know, and I was off the phone in 30 seconds. And if anybody, you know, really did have something to send, they for sure would send it. And then, you know, at my leisure, I could look through it and decide if I wanted to try to take the story on. Well, this old guy called me up and said, "Yeah, boy, have I got a story for you. There's no gold left in Fort Knox." I went, "Okay, well, send me something." And two or three days later, sure enough, he did. And it was about an inch and a half, 2-inch thick sheaf of papers. Packet of papers, and in there were correspondence between himself and the Secretary of the Treasury, the Director of the Bureau of Mint, senators, congressmen, yada yada. This guy was not a nut. He had really gone after this. His name was Ed Durrell, and he became a friend of mine, and I just forget whether I ever asked him, "Hey, how did you ever figure this out in the first place?" But somehow he had gotten onto the fact that there was no gold left in Fort Knox. And it was 1965 and 1965. 1971 or 72, they drained it out through something called the London Gold Pool. Now, you know, check this. Gold is supposed to be self-regulating and all this stuff. Well, not. In order to try to suppress the price of gold, the theory was, well, we're going to sell all of Fort Knox's gold into London at whatever it was, $28 an ounce, right? We're going to sell it to, you know, suppress the price. And all that was going on were the rich private guys, you know, private bankers or whatever in London were just buying that stuff up at $28 an ounce, you know, knowing that as soon as the government ran out, it was going to skyrocket. And that's exactly what happened. And the gold bugs version of this story is, oh, that evil Richard Nixon, he closed the gold window and then the price started to go up. He closed the gold window because there was no more gold. He had no more to sell. And so, you know, that then immediately, you know, within a couple of years, these people that bought it up at 28 were then, you know, able to sell it for a couple hundred. They made 10 times their money, or they just held on to it, you know, and now it's 1300. So, you know, you can't tell me that, you know, a gold money system creates stability. It creates stability. It probably could create stability if the government actually had control over the quantity, but I'm not even sure of that. The history of gold is not good in this area. And you know, then the gold bugs will say, well, the history of fiat money is not good either. There's never been a fiat money that's ever, you know, existed. It always self-destruct. It's just not true. Fiat money worked great for 700 years, as you alluded to earlier, with the invention of the tally stick, where King Henry in 1100 AD wanted to do exactly that. He wanted to take away the money creation power, the money manipulation power from the goldsmiths. And so he created this totally what you call fiat money, little sticks of wood with notches cut in them to make the denomination of the money. And then they'd split the stick in half. The king would keep one half as a counterfeit prevention because, you know, you could have your hands chopped off if you were caught, you know, counterfeiting a tally stick. And as far as I know, there's never been an example of anybody doing it for that reason, actually. So it worked really well. And then the king made tally sticks good for the payment of taxes. And so anytime you declare anything good for the payment of taxes, it instantly becomes money, whether you want it to be money or not. And so it circulated as money. And, you know, this put a heck of a dent in the gold bug's little fractional reserve lending deal where, you know, you deposit 10 gold coins with the gold banker or the goldsmith. Those were the early bankers. And they'd start immediately passing out IOU notes saying that they had, you know, 10 gold coins in here, and this represents the 10 gold coins, but then they, you know, great, it's just irresistible. You know, then they passed out another note to somebody else and another, and, you know, pretty soon they were lent out 100 to 1, and then there'd be a run on the gold bug bank, and, you know, the bank, the guy, they'd kill the gold bug because he didn't have the money, didn't have the gold, and, you know, so that's a story has been repeated all the way up through history time and time again whenever these guys have control of the quantity. So I'm rambling on.
No, that's perfect. I think that really, you know, that kind of goes to the heart of this. And while I understand that politicians and governments are corrupt and can't be trusted, I think on the flip side of this, there is this religion around gold and many times around the power of the free market. And not that I don't believe in that, but it is this religion. And if you contradict that whatsoever, if you know say a single bad word, then suddenly you're labeled a statist or a socialist just for simply bringing up the issue. Which I think is really stupid, and it shuts down the argument, and then it's basically either gold or nothing. You know, either gold or you're a socialist, and we're not going to talk to you at all about anything.
Well, it's all this Austrian economic nonsense, the Ludwig von Mises whole thing, and the the Austrian there's a whole anarchist wing to the Austrians, and you know they believe that you know if we only didn't have any government, then you know everything would just be hunky dory, you know, and they completely ignore the rule of law, and you know there's only one option to the rule of law, and that's the law of the jungle, and you know that's good if you've got a bunch of gold and a bunch of guns and a real secure fortress house, you know, then you're going to be okay. But not everybody has that. You know, the vast majority of people don't have any gold. You know, and so it's the whole, you know, if money is scarce and you've got some of it, then you're good. But if money, if you don't have any of that scarce money, then you're a peasant, you're a serf, and you know you'll work for anybody for any amount of money, you know, just to get a little bit of money just for your daily bread, and that's where scarce money comes in. And gold is the ultimate in scarce money systems, and it's not good for human freedom. It's never served the cause of the middle class or broadening self-governance or freedom. It only serves the moneyed class, what we call the plutocracy. And so, you know, I just can't support that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I used to go to Mises.org daily and read all sorts of articles. I listen to all, you know, their presentations, and they're very well done, and they can be very persuasive. But when you start looking into Mises himself, you know, who funds him? Rockefeller. You know, paid for him to come here, paid for him. He didn't even really, as far as I know, he didn't even really actually receive a salary from NYU when he was a visiting professor. The Rockefeller Foundation funded him. And of course, the Rockefellers, JP Morgans, they have continually pushed for a gold standard, right?
Right. And in fact, there's this very famous Morgan quote, which I probably won't be able to dig up instantly, but as we talk, maybe I can, that I'm a man of the world and I'm a gold bug, and I support a gold bug government, and I love chaos and war. You know, and that's exactly what the gold bug thing leads to.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, and you'll hear gold bugs and others talk about the idea of the New World Order, which is good. I mean, that's good and fine. I mean, I'm not doubting that that doesn't exist in some way. But, you know, who's behind that? It is people like the Rockefellers. It's people like Robert Zoellick at the World Bank, who called a few years ago for a gold standard. I mean, how can you stand next to these people who believe in the most insane sort of policies and whatnot. I really can't understand it. And it's sad that a lot of people get very mixed up in this. And I don't think that they're well-intentioned. I think they really do care about monetary policy, but you get stuck in this religion around gold, and it can be dangerous.
Yeah, it's as I just be repeating myself. It never serves the public interest. It only serves the interest of plutocracy. It doesn't serve the American values of maximizing human freedom. And so that's the deal. And the whole von Mises thing, as you said, he was paid. Paid to come here by the Rockefeller Foundation. NYU never paid his salary. The Rockefellers did. The Rockefellers have admitted that they're interested in this New World Order concept. They're not interested in American patriotism or American sovereignty. They want to destroy that. Why? Because, you know, the founding fathers of the United States set up this government very cleverly under a concept that is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, but is at the very heart of the Constitution. And that concept is called the separation of powers concept. And that's where the only way people can remain free is to maximally deconsolidate power. So you have a bunch of little power centers where people, you know, are competing. And if one guy gets too much power and tries to become a dictator, the other three or four guys can jump on him, you know, and put things right again. And what's the separation of powers concept on the international level? What's the thing that keeps this whole world dictatorship thing from actually coming into force? It's the individual power of the nation state. For example, Hitler almost won. And what's the only thing that prevented Hitler from winning? The U.S. coming into the war. A whole bunch of nation states jumped on him and were, barely able to defeat him. And nation states are a sloppy way to do business, an inefficient way. It's causes warfare, but it's the only thing that keeps the world relatively free. And the whole concept is eventually, people would get less interested in barbarously trying to march into their neighbor's nation and take it over. And eventually we can tone this thing down into a more peaceful state of affairs. But as you see, it keeps kicking up, and as we saw with Putin and Russia just last week. And who was the first nation to come to Putin's aid and support? It was China saying, "Oh yeah, well we think big nations like us have a right to go in and swallow up other countries." Mm. Of course, what China wants to do is to run right over Taiwan as soon as they find some sort of justification. So, it's still a barbarous place, and the only thing that keeps us free is this separation of powers concept. And so that's why I'm all about deconsolidation of power at every level of governance, international, national, state, regional, countywide, everything. You always have to – it's a struggle to try to keep power deconsolidated.
Mm. Well, as we start wrapping up here, can we just kind of touch on this, because we do see throughout history – despite some of the kind of rewriting of history that we see, that with a massive financial catastrophe, many times there is this push by the privately owned central banks to return to some form of gold standard. Do you see that as a possibility in the near future, or is that kind of a little bit too pessimistic a thought?
No, it's not too pessimistic at all. I mean, Alan Greenspan, former Fed chairman, was a big gold bug. While he was Fed chairman, he didn't mention anything about it. But as soon as he got away from the Fed, he's right back to supporting gold-backed money. As you said, the head of the World Bank. Now, whether they actually do that, because the reputation of gold in the past 10 years has been tainted quite a bit. Now we have the big banks involved in manipulation of gold price, and so it's becoming more easy for people to see that gold is not the panacea that it's been claimed to be over the last 30 or 40 years. But that's okay. They can come up with something else. So whether they'll actually go with gold or whether they'll come up with something else that they can easily control, who knows? But we just have to try to keep money maximally decentralized, and that's why I support cryptocurrencies, because it can be maximally decentralized. People can simply make up their own money.
Mm. Yeah, and of course you see a lot of people who follow sort of Austrian school, they love Bitcoin. They don't seem to see any problem with that, which is a completely, yes, it's digital, but I mean, essentially it's sort of like a fiat money. I mean, it's created out of nothing. What is a Bitcoin,
Right, well, it's people during the Depression of the 1930s, there were 3,000 complementary currencies that just sprang up naturally throughout the country. And, of course, the United States has had, ever since its inception, has been the root of monetary experimentation. So complementary currencies, fine with the government, as long as it doesn't imitate the look of the U.S. dollar, so you can't claim it was counterfeit money. They're just fine with it. And so that's why the government government is U.S. government has taken a hands-off approach to Bitcoin because it's just another complementary currency, and there's no way in U.S. law you could go after it. So the problem is with the cryptocurrencies is that it's not an ideal situation because the people who create the cryptocurrencies, of course, the creator actually always gets the lion's share. He gets the seniorage. Mm. And ideally, independent national governments should create their own money and get the seniorage and have the control. Now, with cryptocurrencies, the control issue is kind of solved because they all expand, you know, at a known rate. And so that's good. And the creators, they deserve some of the seniorage because they do go to a lot of work making these things. But ideally, national governments in the future should create their own independent cryptocurrencies, in my opinion. Maybe that's the way it will go. Maybe not. Maybe there'll be all these different competing forces. But it's going to be a very interesting monetary future we're looking at.
Absolutely. Well, just as we close up right here, Bill, something I really always appreciate in your films and in your talks is that you always stay positive and you always try to have a positive message. So, you know, we just talked about cryptocurrencies, complementary currencies. What are the major solutions to much of this crisis?
Well, the first step, as I said before, is we have to eliminate the ability of the federal government to borrow, not just retard it or try to cut back the rate of expansion. We have to blow it out of the water. No more borrowing, no more national debt. And, you know, then we have to create a money system that serves the public interest. There are many different ways to do this. I'm not going to go into many of the different ones right now, but it just has to serve the public interest and has to maximize decentralization to the greatest extent that's politically feasible. And, one other thing I just say to people, not everything is a conspiracy. There are conspiracies in this world, but in my experience, and I've been on this a long, long time, there's a lot fewer conspiracies than people think.
Mm. Well, very, very sound advice, because I know in the alternative media movement, it is very easy to get sort of sucked down the rabbit hole. And like you said, I mean, there are conspiracies. And I know you've talked about that on your show before, JFK, things like that. But yeah, not everything is a conspiracy. And of course, you know, you have to stay positive, or else then you're never really going to progress whatsoever as a society, as an individual. And that's what I really appreciate about your work, is that you always try to stay positive at the end.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of people out there making a whole lot of opportunistic money claiming that everything's a dark, evil conspiracy and we're already a slave state. And you just can't do that. People won't resist if we're already a slave state. If we are already a slave state, how come we're having this conversation today?
Excellent, excellent. Bill, thank you so much for coming on the show. As I said, it's an honor to be speaking with you. And as I said, I think this is a really important thing. And even if you don't agree with this, I think it's important to simply have the discussion. I mean, that's really what it's all about. But please, briefly, tell all the listeners where they can find your work, how they can support you, about your YouTube channel, anything like that.
Yeah, well, my YouTube channel is my primary mode of talking to people on a daily basis. I try to put up another topic every day now. It's Be Still and the number 3. My website's pretty easy. It's www.billstill.com. And between those two things, you can find out everything you need to know if you want to buy stuff or if you want to donate stuff to keep it going. Trust me, there's no money in monetary reform. There's no governments that support me. There's no banks that support me. I'm on my own. And that's the way it is.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for joining us on the show. As I said, it was just an honor and a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, so that was our conversation with the one and only Bill Still. I really do encourage all the listeners to go to the show notes and check out Bill's films. They're all just so excellent, so well made, with lots of information. And even if you don't agree with his approach to monetary reform, he presents a really, really interesting point, and I think it's important to explore all options when it comes to this and not just get stuck on one. Well, I hope that you all enjoyed the podcast, and if you did, then please go to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com, and there you can find all of my podcasts. You can download them for free or stream them off the website. You can find my writing and everything else related. And of course, please do follow me through the RSS feed or through the email updates. You know, always follow me on Twitter at Porkins Policy, and please do subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138porkins. So like I said, thanks for listening. If you like the work I'm doing, then please spread it around, send it to a friend, email it, put it on your social media, or simply just tell someone. That really helps a lot. And also, please check out my recent appearance on Tom Secker's Clandestime. We had a really, really good, interesting, fascinating conversation all about the movie Wag the Dog. So please check that out as well. Well, with that, I will leave it there, and I will be talking to you very soon.
I come to speak to you in the defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. Mr. Carlyle said in 1878 that this was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. They tell us that the great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city of the country. We care not upon what line the battle is fought, if they say bimetallism is good, but that we cannot have it until other nations help us. We reply that instead of having a gold standard, because England has, we will restore bimetallism, and then let England have bimetallism, because the United States has. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.